Be seated, please. The court is now ready to hear argument in 081066, Michael T. Jelinek, M.D., in Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare versus Francisco Casas.
May it please the court, Ms. Duncan and Ms. Garza present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Duncan will open the first 12 minutes, and Ms. Duncan will present the rebuttal.
Ms. Garza. Oh, I'm sorry.
Ms. Duncan will present the rebuttal.
That cost you 5 minutes, guys.
Ms. Duncan, please.
May it please the court. I apologize, Mr. Hawthorne. Good morning. As the court knows, the hospitals presented two arguments in favor of reversal. The first is that there is no competent evidence that Mrs. Casas's failure to receive the two medications that had been prescribed for her caused her any additional pain and suffering that she wouldn't have had as a result of the tragedy that she was enduring. And the second is that the trial court erred in failing to accept our proposed instruction on unavoidable accident. Clearly, if there isn't a sexy issue in this case, it's the second one, because that instruction, although indisputably tendered to the trial judge in writing, the trial judge refused it, is now nowhere to be found. But with the court's indulgence, I'd like to spend the first few minutes on the no evidence point, because I think it's simple, it's straightforward, and it's dispositive of this case. In a nutshell, as the court recently confirmed in Guevara, causation in a med mal case has to be established by expert testimony. In this case, all three experts agreed, plaintiff's expert, the defendant's expert, and the treating physician, Dr. Jelinek, agreed that nothing, not receiving those two medications, would not have affected at all the two infections that Mrs. Casas had after surgery, and that she was going to have pain and suffering as a result of the infections she did have.
Well, what about the period of time from when the doctors first saw her until the time she started getting the right medication? There's some evidence in the record that the odor was so horrible they had to bring fans in, and that to me implies that there must have been a great deal of suffering.
That was going to be my next sentence. That the odor that was so horrible, and if any of you know about yeast infections, you will know it is a horrible odor. That was when they had to take the clamps off the surgical incision so that the yeast could be exposed to air. That was the candida, the yeast infection, that all of the experts agreed was not going to be treated by Maxipim or Flagyl. It would not be affected whatsoever.
Didn't Dr. Dowler testify that patients exhibiting her symptoms had infections caused by anaerobic bacteria, which those medications that were not given would have prevented?
I believe on pages 157 and 158, what he testified to is that it's possible that when they did the cultures after the surgery, that there was an infection that was not revealed by the cultures. And that unrevealed infection might have been treated by Maxipim or Flagyl. Now, I think under this court's recent decision in the City of San Antonio versus Pollock, that string of mites and maybes is not competent evidence and can't support the judgment. But that's the most evidence there is in this record. So the hospital asks that the court reverse the judgment and render judgment in the hospital's favor. Now, before you start in on me on the charge preservation issue, I would like to say that even though I went to this law school, I did learn procedure from Scott McCowan, and I made an A in that class. We all learned the same charge preservation rules. I think this case is different than any case, certainly this court has considered, and I've not read of a case that's similar. There's no dispute on this record that the hospital tendered a written unavoidable accident instruction. There's no question, first of all, that the hospital pleaded unavoidable accident. And I don't really think there's any legitimate question that it was raised by some evidence. The hospital tendered a written unavoidable accident instruction.
The unavoidable accident is what? The failure to renew the medication?
No, the pain and mental anguish that Mrs. Casas suffered was caused by a condition outside of anybody's control. And that's the two infections that
she
had.
So you're saying the outcome was unavoidable, but I thought unavoidable accident was the means of towards the outcome. So I'm not sure I understand, under these facts, the propriety of an unavoidable accident instruction.
Well, the way it's been applied, as I understand it, in a Med-Mal case, is that if the injury could have been suffered by a condition, this is outside of any party's control, an unavoidable accident instruction is appropriate. That would be the decision from Corpus in Weisenbarger. That's a written and denied decision. I believe Chief Justice Nye wrote the opinion. So the mechanism here, there's no dispute that she didn't get those two medications. What's at issue is whether not getting those two medications was a cause of her pain or her suffering or her mental anguish. And that's why the instruction was requested. It fits in a Med-Mal case, maybe not in an auto accident case. But there's no dispute that a written instruction was tendered. There's no dispute.
Let me ask about that on the preservation point. In many of the records that we review, the instruction is tendered, and we have a paper copy, and we can actually hold it and look at it. But also, the instruction is read into the record. And the appellate record is not only the clerk's record, but also the reporter's record. So wouldn't the absence of the instruction in the clerk's record been cured by reading into the record what the proposed instruction was?
Certainly it could have.
And
been.
So it could have been preserved that way. Why was it not waived by not having done that?
Well, because the judge said he was going to get his clerk, when his clerk returned, to file stamp the written instruction we had given. So there was no indication to trial counsel that there was any need to read it into the record. Now, certainly, as Ms. Garza was telling me before we started, prudent course would be to do both, because you never know when a piece of paper is going to get lost. But that wasn't done here.
Couldn't you have done it when counsel realized that it was not in the record? Could you not have done some kind of a bystander's bill, something of that nature? Aren't there other procedures to make the record complete?
There could be. There could be a bystander bill. There could be an agreement between counsel. I think even a cursory look at the Casas' brief would say that agreement was not going to happen. That would be futile. But by the time it was realized that this instruction wasn't in the record, obviously it takes some time to get the record prepared, et cetera. Any number of calls went to the clerk's office asking, where is this instruction? Please ask the judge if he still has it. Please ask the judge's clerk if he has it. It's just gone. So
at that point, there's no way of making a record on it, though?
At that point.
Even going to the judge and.
At that point, I believe the judge's power over the case had expired.
Was it just a standard instruction, unavoidable accident instruction? Do we know?
Well, that's our problem. Is, you know, part of our burden is to show that what we tendered was substantially correct.
Right.
And without the piece of paper, we can't show that. Part of the argument we've made is that certainly opposing counsel and the trial judge, no one suggested there was anything incorrect about this instruction. And Mr. Bassan argues that I'm trying to flip.
Is it the other side's counsel to make that
objection? That's exactly what he argues, is that he had no burden to object. And I'm not suggesting that he did. All I'm stating is the fact that he didn't. There's no suggestion in the record.
Well, that's kind of like you cited the city of San Antonio versus Pollock. There's no duty to do anything because there's an analytical gap. Why speak up, right?
Well, the reason I would have spoken up had I been there was in representing the plaintiffs is to avoid a remand. Because I think, you know, in the Payne case, the state's premise defect question was affirmatively incorrect. And what the court said was there should be but one test for preservation of charge error. And that is, did you make the trial judge aware of your specific complaint and get a ruling? And we did that. So what I would propose is the way out of this mess, it seems to me, that when the trial judge has undertaken the duty, or not the duty, but has undertaken to file the signed, refused, written instruction, to get it filed through his clerk, and somehow, some way, that doesn't happen, there should be a presumption that it was substantially correct. Just like in a bill of review case, if there's an official mistake, we'll say the judgment's invalid. If the court reporter loses all or part, material part of the record, you get a new trial. That's all we're saying, is the judge said he was going to do it. Either he didn't do what he said he was going to do, or his clerk didn't follow instructions. It's one or the other. And under those circumstances, we're arguing that there should be a presumption that it was substantially correct.
The trial court did not require filing of pretrial orders that included all the proposed motions in limine, the exhibits, instructions, jury charge, none of that was required.
They had a charge conference, informal charge conference off the record in chambers, followed by a formal charge conference on the record.
But no requirement to file a week, 2 weeks, 30 days before trial, a proposed pretrial that included all the things I mentioned.
No, no. Okay. So we, and I still say the easy way out of this is to reverse and render judgment for the hospital on the basis of no evidence. But if the court wants to tackle official mistake in not getting that instruction filed, that's the way I suggest you do it.
Any further questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to switch pages a little bit here. This is a frivolous case. It's a bad report. And this case should have been dismissed way back when our motion to dismiss was filed.
Well, that's what your side always says. So let's go beyond that.
Okay, well, plaintiffs filed a wrongful death action. No doubt about it. Original petition was wrongful death. At 180 days, their petition was wrongful death. At the time we filed our motion to dismiss, their allegations were wrongful death. Dr. Dowler's report mentions nowhere anything about Ms. Gaza's death. For that reason, there are other reasons, but for that reason alone, this report is insufficient. It doesn't address the pleadings. It doesn't address the allegations. The allegations at all relevant time was Mrs. Gaza's wrongful death.
I thought when the trial court rejected, or at the time of dismissal, one or the other, the pleadings at that time were not wrongful death anymore. They had dropped that claim.
At the time of the hearing, yes.
At the time of the hearing.
But what former Article 4590I did was it was 180-day, I guess, safe harbor. You have 6 months to get a report to look at this case, and you determine, is it a frivolous case? Does it have merit? You get the report, and what 4590I did that 74 doesn't do is it gave you the option to non-suit within those first 180 days.
But if you have a claim that the doctor did something wrong to your client and it injured your client, isn't the negligence, whether it caused death or it simply caused some other injury short of that, what you're talking about in your report is whether the doctor was negligent and did it cause some type of injury? And wouldn't a prudent lawyer, once you get a doctor's report that doesn't link it up to death, say, well, still that same negligence caused injuries just short of death? Isn't that what a lawyer should do?
A lawyer should do that within the 180 days.
Why?
Because that's what the law provided for. And at least even...
It provided for the amendment. It limited the lawyer to the amendment of pleadings in 180 days.
Let me back up. It could have done it within 180 days, or at least before we filed our motion to dismiss. At the time that the objection and the motion to dismiss was made as to that report, those were the allegations.
We have requirements about when the report has to be filed, and that's the 180 days?
That's correct.
All right, under the law that was applicable at this time. What does the law say about when the plaintiff can amend?
Well, a plaintiff can amend their petition anytime they want.
Okay, so the law doesn't address that. It just says the report has to be filed within 180 days.
Correct, but the report has to address the allegations that are on file during that time period. Those allegations were not made during those 180 days.
I just want to be clear. You're here seeking attorney's fees. That's what the case is all about.
Absolutely.
What's the approximate amount that you're seeking?
At this point, at the time of the hearing, it was $9,000. That was in 2004. Dr. Jelinek was not non-suited until 2005, a couple months before trial. So there would have been, I don't know the exact amount, but there would have been a significant amount of attorney's fees from 2004 through the non-suit in 2005, and then, of course, the appellate fees. And if I may just very briefly address...
Well, if there are questions.
I have another question. At the trial, the jury found 5% negligence on the doctor. In Ibram, we said that if... Would you address the question that I'm about to pose? That we said that if you go through trial and there's a finding of negligence supported by evidence, well, then you, by not bringing up an interlocutory appeal, you have...
And I'd like to say two things about that, because I do remember that argument about a year ago in Ibram. In this particular case, there was a 5% finding. Actually, what the jury charge said was 5% Dr. Jelinek directly or by agent or employee Dr. Romero. So we don't know whether they found him negligent, whether they found his employee negligent. Dr. Jelinek was not a party at the time of the trial. We don't know if anybody even discussed the employee-agency relationship between him and Dr. Romero. So I don't think that finding of 5% negligence even addresses whether the claims had merit or not.
Under Ibram.
Under Ibram. And also, the fact that, and this sort of came up during Ibram, is the 180 days is a bright line rule. It's just like the statute of limitations. If you have an absolute 2-year statute of limitations and you have the most meritless, the most awful case brought 2 years, and 5 days late, it's late. That's the same thing that the legislature was doing with the 180 days. Basically, and as far as the attorney's fees issue goes, it's to deter. And if, yes, the claim was non-suited, but if the attorney's fees aren't awarded, it's just not having that deterrent effect.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Garza. The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Maslin will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I don't know what the court preference is with regards to the sequence of the argument, since it's reversed a couple times with regards to the petitioner hospital. But I will address, I guess, since she went first with the no evidence points, is that I took great pains, I think, to contain within our brief page upon page upon page of facts that were elicited in the trial court. That was from every nurse that testified, that was from every doctor that treated, that was from the medical records, that was from the hospital's only expert, and from the expert the plaintiffs retained. And each of those people, every single one of them, indicated that the standard of care was to provide antibiotic treatments for the type, since she had the colon cancer, and then the resection at all times, not just periodically, but for the entire hospital stay. We had the chief of the pharmacy said that that should have been done. Within the confines of petitioner's argument really lies that the only mental anguish could have come from the, quote, cancer, and I guess arguably the surgery itself. But that disregards part of what we have briefed, which is the particularly disturbing events of what happened. You have to consider, I think, in the context of this case, and of great significance, and the jury heard it over and over, was that this lady, the antibiotics that should have been delivered to her, the Flagyl and the Maxipa, there was an empty IV bag, and it stayed there in her room 24 hours a day for almost 5 days. Not one nurse noticed it. Not one doctor noticed it.
Do you think there has to be evidence that the maxipine and Flagyl would have been effective to treat?
No.
And it's your position. I was not quite clear from your brief, but I think it's your position that whether it would have been or not, what she suffered from was knowing that something was supposed to be given and it wasn't.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's two. Well, actually, there's one more. Dr. Dowler was clear is that, and what counsel suggests is that anaerobic might possibly, and that's not the context of how he described it. He described the type of purulent smell, and keeping in mind, as Justice Medina indicated, that this went on for a number of days. This is not just the candida, as counsel suggests. The evidence was that this had gone on for a number of days, that they had to bring in fans to dissipate as much they could the purulent, necrotic, rotting smell in that room.
Do you agree that there is no evidence that she did have an infection post-surgery that maxipine and Flagyl would have treated?
No, I do not agree.
As opposed to that there might have been?
No, okay. It's not a might have been.
What is the evidence that she did have an infection that treated?
Dr. Dowler says that the very type of infection, the symptom, if you would, or the sign of the purulent smell, is a sign of a anaerobic bacteria. You can never prove an anaerobic bacteria because, by definition, when it hits the air, it's gone. So a negative finding of anaerobic bacteria can never be found. So medically speaking...
But I thought he testified that it also could have been the candida.
It could have been. At some point in time, yes. There's no question about that. But the bottom line is that from a medical standpoint, when you have anaerobic bacteria, you as a plaintiff, or if you were a defendant and needed to prove it, you can never literally prove it except by your own experience. And keeping in mind that Dr. Dowler not only was a teaching professor at John Seeley down in Galveston, but in other universities, he also had degrees in microbiology and toxicology and pharmacology. All of these elements came into play when the jury listens to it, and that also gets us to the point, from a standpoint of an evidentiary standpoint, is the jury is entitled to believe whoever they want to believe, based assuming they have sufficient credentials. And in this case, it's obvious that the jury believed, and you have to believe Dr. Dowler. You also have to consider from the facts...
Counsel, the jury, there's some further limitations on what a jury is entitled to believe. An expert has to have sufficient credentials, as you said, but if an expert just says it's possible that something happens, we've said over and over again, that's not legally sufficient evidence.
Well, I don't think he said possible, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just saying that that's an additional limitation on what a jury...
I think he testified within medical probability that anaerobic bacteria would have been treated by Flagyl and Maxipam if given. That's what I believe he testified.
And we've said that the medical expert doesn't have to use those terms, but if they do, that makes it clear. And you're saying he said within reasonable medical probability and then gave his opinion.
I feel comfortable that I asked the question in that manner. We're 5 years out from the jury trial, and I don't recall
everything. The question is then, is there only one type of anaerobic bacteria, or... How did he get to the point of saying whatever the anaerobic bacteria, assuming that smell indicated an anaerobic bacteria, whatever bacteria was causing it was sensitive to the flagyl and maxipine.
Because it was explained to the jury that those are the two most broad-based antibiotics used.
But
and they're used everywhere in the United States to hit these types of anaerobic bacteria. You don't know which one it is. But they're very broad-based antibiotics.
So was there testimony that they would hit all of them, or are there some that are not sensitive to it? Did he discuss that at all?
My recollection, Your Honor, that was not to that specifics. Is that these are the most broad-based antibiotics known in medicine at the time that were always utilized in this type of procedure. But in addition to just the use of the antibiotics, we have to, and I think we have to consider the fact of the traumatic effect of finding out. This lady was in remission of cancer, the evidence in this case shows. In May of 2005, there was a reoccurrence. That's why she goes into the hospital in July to see what they can do. Now you have to think, and you know, this is I don't think really that complicated. You have a person who's been a fighter, by uncontradicted, she's been a fighter. She goes in to have a surgery. Now, what does that tell a person? That tells a reasonable person, I think, that she's still a fighter, because if she just wants to give up, she doesn't do anything. She goes into this hospital. She has the surgery. She's still a fighter after the surgery. It's only when, and the evidence is very clear in this, a downward spiral in her case. It's only when she is told that the medication she was supposed to be given weren't delivered or weren't given, and she's had this problem before that is discovered. You have to consider also that in this context that this jury heard from defense counsel in both voir dire and in opening statement, the hospital messed up. They're sorry they messed up and they won't do it again. That's what this jury heard. You take that in context with all of the evidence. You have, and Justice Heck, you mentioned some other evidentiary, or asked about some other evidentiary. And in this case, Dr. Dowler also testified that matters contained within the record also indicate pain or anguish. Not necessarily from not getting the antibiotics, but we have tachycardia, we have elevated blood pressure, which could be considered the same assuming it gets to a certain level. And then you also had a long-term elevated temperature. All of those are medical signs that a person is suffering from both pain and or mental anxiety, if you will.
Mr. Maston, can you address that instruction that was lost?
Well, I don't know. Counsel has made giant leaps that it was lost. It was not stamped, that we know, because if it had been stamped, it would be easy to cure that, the file stamped. There was an informal charge. The petitioner in this case is
taking... Informal charge conference, you mean?
Yes, I'm sorry. Informal charge conference.
Back in chambers?
Back in chambers, off the record. There was an instruction in writing, but the petitioner's actions in this court take a quantum leap and really, I think, set pain on its head by now saying there is a presumption that if you hand a trial court an instruction or a definition you want, and it doesn't show up somewhere in the record, it should be automatically reversed. Well, that...
Why is that... addressed her argument that if you handed it to the court reporter and it got lost, that would be grounds for a new trial, but why is it not if you hand it to the clerk and it gets lost, or to the judge?
I don't know who they handed it to start off with. I know the judge had one.
Why should the rule be different?
Well, the rule should be that, and she talked about, I went to South Texas and Justice Spurgeon Bell.
Then you probably learned there that you need to check, make sure all the documents are submitted.
You know, we actually worked on that. We also were taught we'd get a file stamp copy and keep one. We don't have one in this case. So I think we can presume that it wasn't done that way, the way it should have been done.
That's true, counsel. The record says, counsel, you know, during this exchange in open court, taken down by the court reporter, counsel says, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, the originals of this instruction are in your office. I'm talking about the original signatures on the instruction. The court says, quote, they're right here. I'll have the clerk, when he comes in, stamp file these. Any other objections? So the court says, I've got them. They're the originals. I've signed them, refusing.
Rhetorically speaking, what does that mean? We don't know, because we don't have, using the words sudden emergency, using the words unavoidable accident, what does that mean? Could they have contained within those? This court doesn't know. because it's not in the record.
But if we go to the question, can you not file documents with the judge?
Can you file
documents with the trial judge?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm just not following what you're saying.
Well, if you give a document to the clerk and
right.
they file stamp it, it's filed. If you give a document to the clerk and say, I'm filing this, and they don't file stamp it,
well, that's
still filed?
That's not the real world, is it?
Well, but we do have those things happen. And now, if you give a document to a trial judge, say after the clerk's office is closed, you drive to the judge's house and hand it. Can you file a document with the judge?
You can file a document
All right,
with the
so
judge.
So if the judge is in chambers and you hand it to the judge and you say, Your Honor, this is our request and instruction, the judge says, I've got it taken care of. Why is that not filed, as
because,
we call it, term?
Because it's not stamped as an official record of the court. Does the stamp make it filed,
or
yes.
does the handing it to the person with the intent that it be filed make it filed?
Well, my personal opinion, Your Honor, that's fool's play just to hand it and not have it filed
well,
stamped.
Maybe, but we have a problem. My question is it filed when you hand it to the judge or the clerk with the intent that it be filed? Do we have any cases on that one way or the other that you're aware of?
No, I think it's a minister. I think you actually have the clerk has to actually, or some official of the court actually has to stamp it. And here's the reason for it, because how easy would it be in a situation, talking, counsel wants a presumption that if you mention words that this is how the presumption is it was done in substantially correct form. How about if this will happen, is that if you see your case going south, the court's not letting in certain evidence, or the witnesses just didn't come across, or one of them that you thought was coming in didn't show up, and you see your case going south, either side, all you have to do is put a definition, instruction, or a question in writing. Don't have it filed in the court. And then later on, say, well, we had it. We talked about sudden emergency. We talked about unavoidable accident, which happened in this case.
This case is much different. The trial judge said, I've got the originals right here. I think this was an open court, wasn't it?
That was an open court.
I'll have the clerk, when he comes in, stamp file these. Are you saying counsel should say, Judge, I don't believe you. Stamp them now or I'm not going away. Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't suggest that. I wouldn't suggest that either. But the normal way it's done, Your Honor, the way I understand it, my 37 years in doing trial practice is you go to the clerk. You give the clerk one, not one. I give them three, and you get them all stamped. Typically what happens is, even if you don't do that, I've seen other attorneys do where they just have one stamp.
Yeah.
But what you do is you take that.
There are better ways to do it, to add a belt to the suspender. But when I was a trial judge, if I said I'm going to get this stamped, you know, I'm making a representation that I'm going to get it done, and it should be taken as done. And if the lawyer said, I don't believe you, I'd say we're going off the record, counsel in chambers.
I would have thought you probably said we're going on record in chambers.
you're not really advocating for anything more. You're not advocating for anything more than what a judge is required to do, which is, for example, give a ruling on your objection
exactly.
when you make it, or when you want a bill of exception, we'll do it after lunch. We'll take it at the next break. You got to keep pressing that judge to make sure that you get that ruling so you can preserve your record.
We do it all the time, Your Honor. We do it when trial exhibits. There's things that are put up on the bench and the court reporter keeps them, but when you go in, you go back through and you check, and you double check, and you triple check what the court admitted in, what the court reporter says she has down, what you have, what the other side has. That's how you do this.
Well, but the problem is not what the regular way of doing it. It's when the ox is in the ditch, when you can't find the document, and you're trying to figure out what procedures are available to protect yourself. And you're not suggesting that there has to be a file stamp, I don't think.
I am suggesting.
Well, if the judge writes on the, and I've done this before, handed a judge something in a courtroom, and he'll write on the document, filed, dated, signed it.
Well, that wasn't done in this case, though, Your Honor.
Well, but I mean, you're suggesting that it has to be a file stamp. And if that document gets lost, what's the parties to do then? The judge has possession of it. You've seen it. It's been marked, filed.
Well, that's part of the adversarial system. That's part of And keeping the record straight so this court doesn't have to guess.
And so if the document is missing and it's an important document, then the remedy is a remand, isn't it?
Well, no. Your Honor, I disagree with you. They could have brought this before the trial court. They could have even in front of the Court of Appeals filed something, but they didn't.
Was there a motion for new trial? Did the hospital file a motion for new trial?
I'm trying to remember that. Seemed like it took about a year before we even had it. I mean, this is not something.
My question goes to if I presume, you know, typically there's a motion for new trial, factual insufficiency, legal insufficiency, but also in this case there would be one about the failure of the trial court to give the requested instruction.
You know, I can't believe that. There's just been too much water in the bridge for me to remember if there's actually
maybe Ms. Duncan can answer, because then if that were one of the points in a motion for new trial, you would presumably the lawyer would look for that instruction in the record to make that point.
Correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
Mr. Mastin, let me short circuit just say, Dr. Jelinek, the pleading, the amendment of the pleading after the filing of the affidavit, and the finding against him in the trial court in connection with our decision, Ibram. Do you have anything to say about those two points?
Well, with regards, the jury obviously found, and it wasn't addressed in any of the briefs, I don't believe, but my memory is there was little to no argument about the negligence statement except from the hospital concerning the doctors trying to throw it off on somebody else.
Right.
But with regards to whether there was negligence presented at trial, it was without question. There was testimony, I think I pointed out in the brief, Your Honor. It talks about how mad he was, how the nurses.
Do you have a position on what that would do to Dr. Jelinek's plea here?
Well, I think it would bar his the plea here.
All right. How about your pleading amendment after from death to non-death?
I think that's the controlling with regards to whether the report is sufficient. And the report, this was not a complicated case of a series of other doctors coming involved. This was a simple question, and Dr. Dowler pointed out, if I might, Your Honor, just very quickly, and I've got it. He said that he went through the whole litany of what he understood reasonable medical probability was and standard of care, and he sets that out. And he says in this specific case, that Dr. Jelinek was failed to monitor and the receiving of medications by Ms. Casas. And confirmed it.
You're going to the affidavit now. I'm going to the question. She says that when he gives his affidavit, your pleading is wrongful death. And then after the affidavit, before the hearing, you change your pleading, well, drop wrongful death.
It was wrongful death and survival.
And survival.
We dropped out the wrongful death because we couldn't prove
so
the wrongful
you at
death.
All times had both.
Correct. And the situation is, Your Honor, is that this was a short window from a medical malpractice standpoint from the problems that Mrs. Casas had. This was not a jury gone wild. Even Dr. Berkowitz, the defendant's expert, the hospital's expert in this case, alluded to and agreed that the failure was below the standard of care. His only question was whether or not flagellum or maximum would have, the ones that were actually, the bacteria actually found, not the anaerobic, would actually have been affected by flagellum maximum. That's all.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Judge O'Neill, if I could first address your question and read to you from Weisenberger. In a medical negligence case, when expert testimony establishes that another physical condition or circumstance was the probable cause of the injury, the definition of unavoidable accident must immediately follow the jury instruction defining proximate cause. That's on page 16 of our brief, a writ denied case from Corpus in 1990.
if I could refer the court, these are cited in our brief, to the page numbers that are cited in our brief, Dr. Dollar testified there could still be other organisms that were not grown out because of the fact that you cannot grow out every time you have a bowel perforation, you don't grow out every organism that's in there. And
did he also use the term reasonable medical probability?
In many respects in his testimony, yes, he said in reasonable medical probability, but not with respect to there being some uncultured, unrevealed anaerobic bacteria in the bowel. And yes, Judge Johnson, you can file with the judge, as you know. You probably had things filed with you. The test, as I remember it, and Mr. Penguin is what comes to mind, but I'd be happy to file a supplemental brief with the court. All my responsibility is, as a lawyer, is to tender something for filing to the clerk. The clerk has a duty to accept it for filing. That was part of the problem with supersedious bonds when we required that they be approved. And the clerks didn't want to approve them, and once they were tendered, they felt that they had to approve them. You know, Judge Wainwright, I'm not going to say to a sitting judge, I don't believe you in chambers. I'm also not going to, particularly in this climate, I'm not going to follow a judge around.
Well, but, I mean, you know, we've all been in trial where everybody at every break is checking to make sure that this actually got admitted and this document's there. So you didn't have to follow the judge around. You could have looked at the record and seen, have we preserved our objections and where's the instruction? And
that's correct.
Could have been cured at the trial court level.
That's correct. And that didn't happen. So this is not a case where there could not have been steps taken.
Was there a motion for the trial?
I don't remember. But why would you include the failure to give an instruction in a motion for a new trial?
Because
at that point we didn't even know it wasn't in the record.
I'm not saying it's required, but if you are telling the trial court you erred by not giving this instruction and you brief it, and you persuade the trial court, then the trial court grants a new trial, and you get rid of a $250,000 judgment or whatever.
Of course, at that point, there was no reason to know that it wasn't going to be in the record.
I'm just saying, if there's a point in a motion for a new trial involving a jury charge problem, then at least I think many lawyers would say, here is the instruction we proposed from the record, and your order was to deny it, we think it's error. And had you gone through that exercise, you would have known it wasn't there and could maybe done something about it.
Possibly.
And it could have been checked before the case went to the jury. I mean, it could have been checked at the close of the evidence.
It could have been.
At many points, it could have been checked.
It could have been.
And cured.
It could have been. No question about it. The problem that we're left with is what is Texas law? When a trial judge says, I will have the clerk, when he returns, file stamp this, and it never gets into the record. That's the question. We'd ask the court to reverse and render on the no evidence point and remand for a new trial on the instruction point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Duncan. The clause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.